Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and it's a good day. Last night I did 2 hours on George Norrie's Coast to Coast. George often highlights some really good authors and good scientists. And today I've already got an additional 3,000 new visitors to Bregan.com. It'll probably go over 5,000 new visitors from talking with George. We had 2 full hours, including an hour of question and answer. Very, very positive. Times are changing out there. And my new book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, this morning became number 15 on the top 100 psychiatric books on Amazon.com, number 15 on the top 100. It's only been out a few weeks. And since it's a medical publisher and a medical book, I think that's especially great. I hope lots of people will be buying this book, which tells the story of why it's bad to stay on psychiatric drugs, why it's harmful to your body and your brain and your spirit to stay on psychiatric drugs for months and years at a time. And then it describes the various adverse reactions and then talks about the safest ways to withdraw from the medications. So I'm feeling pleased today, delighted to be at my new hour, which I hope will be as good or better than my old hour, now 4 o'clock on Wednesdays. My guest today, I think, is going to be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be interesting and stimulating to talk with Penelope Andrade. She's a licensed social worker. She's the author of Emotional Medicine RX. And the subtitle is Cry When You're Sad, Stop When You're Done, Feel Good Fast. I don't know how she remembers that. I guess because it comes from her, deep inside her spirit, she remembers it easily. She's in San Diego. Got a center there. She's got a popular advice column called Transformational Talk that reaches thousands of people in Southern California. And she likes to draw in her therapy on, you know, the traditional, the good, the stuff that really helps people overcome and triumph without resort to psychiatric drugs. Penelope, are you there?
Sure.
Hi, I had such a nice time meeting you on the phone this weekend.
Oh, that was really fun. That was really fun. And I told you then that I am so honored. I am so honored to be on your show and to be making a personal connection with you, one of my heroes for how many decades did we figure out since Talking Back to Prozac?
Well, it came out in 1994. It's
right.
A while.
Right.
Well, it's so gratifying to me, you know, because I didn't know anything about your feeling that you expressed with so much emotion when we talked, that you felt safer because I was in the world ever since Talking Back to Prozac. And I had no idea about that, and it's really wonderful.
Well, that's true, and that brings me to tears again, that I absolutely do feel safer in the world because you are here and because your books sit front and center on my bookshelf and because the information in those books supports me and emboldens me to keep providing information for people that they have the resources within themselves to manage even very difficult experiences.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, why don't you just jump into your own work?
Well, You know, you asked how I remember the title. Well, I remember the subtitle, Cry When You're Sad, Stop When You're Done, Feel Good Fast, because this is what happened to me in my own life in a moment of great distress. I was going through a divorce, a 15-year marriage, had a little darling boy, thought my life was going to go in one direction, and suddenly it was over. You know, life as I knew it was really in pieces at my feet. And being an extrovert and being Irish and being a trauma survivor, I was very emotionally upset by this. I couldn't stop crying. I was a mess. I was an absolute mess. And I've never had an orientation to handle my upsets with medication, so I didn't go in that direction. But I had an experience during this moment of deep distress which changed my life forever and has been so important in my emotional health, my physical health, and for my clients that I decided to write a book about it. And what happened was that as I was going through these days of thinking I would never stop crying and thinking I would never be able to recover from this devastating experience, excuse me, I had an experience one afternoon with an energy healer who was working on my body. I was trying to get massages, acupuncture, whatever would help me. And at one moment, she said to me, and I was crying, and there was a pause, and at one moment, this person said to me, I think you're done now. And I looked into my body, into my experience, and this is where my meditation and my mindfulness training had come in handy. I looked into my experience, and I could see that at that moment, my body was done. I was done. And I got so excited. I mean, the story of what had happened to me, that I was now going to have to find my way as a single mother, and that I was not going to be married to the person that I thought I was for the rest of my life, that story was still operating. But in that moment, I was okay. I was fine. And I practically leapt off that table, and I drove home, and I had this nugget of, to me, Peter, this is a gift from the universe. This is a gift from God, if you believe in God, or from nature, or from great mystery, that our bodies, no matter what we're going through, our bodies have these resources called our emotions. And these emotions, especially the really basic ones, sad, mad, scared, these basic emotions are time limited. They move through very quickly. And when they're done, this is what I discovered in myself. I felt okay. I felt good. Now, does that mean that I didn't cry again during this divorce? No, I actually... It took me about 4 years to get over that. I've been married 15 years. I'm a loyal person. I would have never left. But I had a nugget. I had a talisman I could hold on to take with me through the next storm of grief that would hit me or of anger. And that nugget was to let my body lead, to watch what was happening in my experience, in my body, and stop when my body gave me the signals it was done for the moment. And when I did that, and then when I further discovered, okay, now that my body's done, let me be present with what I'm feeling, I discovered that if I focused my mind, if I focused my awareness on the sensations in my body of peace, of relief, of the best kind of emptiness, if I focused on those experiences that followed every time I was sad or mad or scared, if I focused on those sensations in my body for a couple of minutes, my thoughts would automatically move me toward feeling confident, happy, and peaceful. I'd start having optimistic thoughts. Well, okay, I'll have a new life. Well, okay, I can do this. I'd start feeling better. So, you know, I want people to know about this, and I'm touched as I talk about it, because people need to know that we have resources within us every moment, no matter how awful it seems. That
well,
can help us.
I think it's a wonderful, wonderful message. When you're talking about your body, you're talking about your emotions. I mean, I think you're seeing that as one package. Am I right about that?
Well, sensation and emotion are different. And it's really important to focus on sensations rather than emotion, because sensations are closer to the truth of an experience. Emotions could really quickly go into mental states. Sensations
well,
are sensations.
Talk about that some more, because I'm not totally clear on what you're saying. It sounds very important and certainly very interesting. So try to help me and everyone else see in a very maybe experiential way, you know, really communicating what you mean in terms of yourself or people you work with.
Right.
What feeling the sensations rather than the emotions is about.
Right. So if, for example, if you're feeling sad, you have sensations of your eyes filling with tears, your shoulders maybe rising, your chest feeling full. Those are the sensations, and those sensations are going to let you know when your body's done with feeling sad at this moment. So what's going to happen is you start crying, and then you have sensations of your voice changing, and you may be sobbing, and tears may flow, and, you know, you have these sensations. For you to know when your body's done, I mean, the story that I experienced then and the stories that many of us, not just stories, but the experiences, the life upsets that we have, they don't go away in a few minutes. Those life upsets, you know, they take some time to work through. But your body, I've discovered from personal experience and from the experience of working with thousands of clients, I discovered this in 1984. I've worked with thousands of clients. I've taught thousands of people. Let your body lead, because your body, even in the midst of a big upset, which is going to be fueled by your thoughts. In my case, it was, oh, my God, my marriage is over. My life is over. My beautiful son, our family. That was the story. But my body, each time I would move through some grief or anger about that, my body would signal to me through sensations when it was done for now. And those sensations would be an easing in my shoulders, an easing in my breathing, a sense of relaxation in my face, a sense of relaxation in my stomach. So even though my mind might want to go on telling myself the sad story or the horrifying story or the unjust story, my body was saying, right now, honey, we're done. We're done. And if you choose, you can focus on being done right now. And if you focus on being done right now, you're going to feel better pretty soon. Does that make it clearer?
Yes, I think it's important. I think it's interesting. And it's consistent with certainly my sense of being in touch with your body, as well as what you're calling your emotions, your sensations and your emotions. I'm thinking that sensations are these really concrete bodily manifestations, is what
yes.
you're saying.
Yes.
And it makes sense in terms of welcoming them, you know, letting yourself have all these sensations that you're probably afraid to have at the time, finding ways to welcome them. And I suspect that the treatment you were getting at the time helped you release them, helped you welcome them in some way.
The energy treatment that I was getting at that moment, I mean, I hadn't had, because like I said, I'm an Irish extroverted trauma survivor, for me, the crying part was never difficult. The anger part was never, feeling those feelings was never difficult. For me, stopping, letting them move their simple-minded course, you know, the sensations and the emotions are not neurotic. They're not going to stay stuck or obsessed or fixed on something. They have a natural, simple, elegant course through our experience, and they're done, and that's what I discovered. And, you know, people are typically kind of end up on one side or the other of the spectrum of, are you a person who has a hard time stopping crying or stopping being mad or scared, or are you a person who has a hard time starting feeling any of that? And, of course, there are, you need to pay different attention to different things if you're one of those persons like me who needed to learn how to stop, how to track when my body was done so that I could experience the peace. And I wanted to say, you know, I quoted to you from one of your books when I talked to you on Sunday, and I want to quote again for listeners, because you say something that is so important. Excuse me, I'm burping. And burping is another sign that the body is processing stress. It's a sensation that I pay a lot of attention to in my sessions. When people burp, I know we're on the road toward integrating the experience emotionally. So, as a matter of fact, I say burping is good so often, somebody made me a really cute pillow that says burping is good. So I have that in my office here. At any rate, you say in your book, yes, your drug may be your problem. You say the idea of welcoming painful emotions may seem beyond the capacity of many people when they are severely distressed. By the time they're upset enough to consider turning to therapy or to drugs, they usually want to get rid of your emotions. And then you say, it is unfortunate and potentially tragic that many therapists and doctors go along with this wish for the self-destruction of strong feelings. To be genuinely helpful, they should instead remind their patients that strong emotions of any kind are necessary and potentially liberating signals or reflections of their psychological or spiritual state. Now that is, to me, that is just brilliant, fabulous. That's absolutely right. And that you, a psychiatrist, have said that and say it and have been saying it for decades and have been holding true to that and have been gathering people to you is just, it just gives me chills. I'm just so grateful for you doing that. And I would add to your paragraph.
Yes.
Is that I would add that strong emotions of any kind are delivery systems for well-being.
I like that.
Delivery systems.
You talked about how some people can't stop having their feelings. Others are afraid to have their feelings. Something I think that's fairly common in people who have been very much traumatized is a kind of combination of that, where the person is afraid to have their feelings because they feel their feelings will overwhelm them and never go away, that they will cry forever.
Right.
Tell me about it. Respond to that. If
yeah,
I'm your
exactly.
patient,
that's
telling
exactly
you that.
Right. And I have so many things to say about that. The first part of that is that the reason they think their feelings will go on forever is because they keep getting stimulated by the story of the tragedy, the injustice, or the hurt. Not the body, because the body is very efficient. So that's one thing, and I want to train people. I try to train people about that. I try to teach them. Let the body lead, because hysteria, this on and on and on of emotion, is a mentally driven experience, not an embodied experience. So that's a one point that I make that I feel very strongly about, and I've had it in my own experience, and I see it in clients. If people can't stop crying, they're up in their heads. Because your body wants to get back to the beach. It wants to go play. It's ready after, you know, I mean, one neuroscientist that I talked to the other day said, you know, 90 seconds and an emotion is done. I think I've seen it more like 3 minutes, really strong. I mean, 3 minutes of a really strong embodied feeling is a lot. And if the body is usually ready for a little rest after that. So that's the first thing I want to say to that. The second thing I want to say is that when people have had terrible childhood traumas and been alone and not had anybody there to help them, the psyche and the body, in its beneficence, really, in its benevolence, shuts down. Because little ones, little tiny ones who are having these terrible traumas and they're not having, you know, skilled parents or parenting people around them to help them be present, the psyche can't handle it, so they do shut down. So that's why if you are a person who is on the other end of the spectrum from me, and I talk about this in my book, I talk about both ways. If you're a person who has more an experience of numbness and dissociation and you can't feel your feelings, that's a really important sign that you need to get help. You need professional help with this. You need, you know, and I love, Peter, I love what you say. People need people, not pills. You know, if you are a person who has this numbness or if you have hysteria, which I'm saying is, you know, afraid it's never going to stop, you need to have a person with you, an empathic person, who is going to help you gently and carefully and slowly. And this is where the sensations comes in, because what we now know from trauma work and the work of Peter Levine, somatic experiencing, is that we can help unwind that trauma and bring the nervous system back into some enough balance so that people can feel sad, mad, or scared. Because that's where the power is. You know that. I mean, that's what I get from your books. We know that,
yes.
Right?
Yes, we're on a very similar track about the importance of emotions.
And you say, what? You know, in another book, in your Drug May Be Your Problem, you talk about, in Toxic Psychiatry, you talk about minor tranquilizers, like any sedative, can be harmful in the long run. And this is minor. This is people who think this stuff is okay, right? Oh, it's just minor. It's not that bad. Not only because they are habit-forming and addictive, but because they cover up anxiety by suppressing the capacity of the brain to generate feelings. Yes. The brain, as usual, tries to overcome the suppression and reacts in ways we cannot begin to predict or fully comprehend. As we have seen, drug-induced rebound anxiety is one common effect. So here's the drugged individual with a suppressed and confused anxiety signal living under a considerable handicap. At the least, feelings are pushed down, and with that, self-awareness is muted. And I say self-awareness and all and will and confidence and power and action potential, which is what emotions give us.
Now, in your discussion of emotions, you don't, as you're talking today, you're not focusing at all on guilt and shame. I think you are on anxiety in terms of fear. Where do guilt and shame fit into your way of thinking about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And okay, so I would see guilt as a mental state which needs to be worked through when a person has the capacity to feel what they feel about it. I wouldn't see guilt as an emotion. I see that the emotion underneath guilt may be shame, may be dissociation or numbness. I mean, not that dissociation, numbness is not an emotion. I would say that underneath guilt, you would have, you would have the sensations or the neurological experience of numbness or dissociation. You may have grief. You may have, anger, you may have shame. Now, shame, you know, people have been back and forth on whether or not shame is a primary emotion. The six emotions that are kind of worldwide seen based on the research of Paul Ekman are sad, mad, scared, glad, surprised, and disgust. But they don't mention shame. But Dr. Keltner, who is at the University of California and his Greater Good Institute, has done some very convincing research to say that shame is also, you know, it's a primary emotion. I'm not sure, because babies aren't born with shame. That seems to come a little later. It's a very useful experience of the community to control behavior. But I would put shame in the post-traumatic stress category, I would put it as a sympathetic nervous system arousal relating to anxiety more than as a primary emotion. But are they both essential? Absolutely. To work through guilt and shame, to be present, to drop in my, you know, what I would encourage is to, you know, help people drop in what they're experiencing in their body. Now, I know that your books, Peter, are filled with the most inspiring stories, and I encourage everybody who hasn't read them to go out and read them and buy them. They're filled with the most inspiring stories of huge breakthroughs that you've had with people when they've uncovered some of these early traumas. And so, you know, I haven't seen you do a session, but I can only imagine that you provide a container of safety and presence so that people are able to drop in to their whole-bodied experience of some event or memory that was traumatic that led to the guilt or led to the shame, and that you help them move through it so that at the end, not only are, you know, their nervous system is balanced, but their psyche is open, and they have access to these resources of self-confidence and will and ability to move forward in life.
I do have a training film, Penelope, that is available on my website.
And, oh, good.
I am certainly very much in agreement with you that it can be incredibly helpful to get at trauma and help people relieve it. I think the whole starting key, and we probably agree on this, is the relationship. It's the safe, caring, meaningful relationship we develop with our clients. And from that, you know, that they can feel the experience of actually being safe with another human being, which they may never have had or may have had in very conflicted ways. And that's the building block that I start with. When I was a young therapist, I contacted people who'd been in my practice that I thought had benefited, and some people who were doing well in my practice, and I asked them if they'd talk to me for an hour, obviously no charge, about what they felt they'd gotten from the therapy. And I expected them to say, you know, well, a lot of your interpretations and a lot of my getting back and understanding what had happened to me as a child. But actually, they all sort of said the same thing, which was that you cared about me so much that I started to care about myself.
Yeah.
And I think that's, to me, is like the starting point. So I've had less emphasis in my own mind on the reliving or re-understanding and integrating the trauma, although it's an important part. But I think the starting key is an empathic, caring relationship.
Absolutely. And research bears that up.
Yeah, I think it does, doesn't it?
Yeah, research shows us that the only variable across all therapies, you know, all therapies have similar success and failure rates. The one variable across them all is the quality of the relationship with the therapist.
Yeah.
So
I think that's really, really true. And that research goes back to the days of Rogers. And
definitely.
From the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's true in life as well, that probably a degree of a person's happiness, not even probably, I do believe the degree of a person's happiness and feeling of well-being really turns on the quality of the relationships that they have in life, including a relationship with the mysterious, as you put it, I think, earlier, or God, and with people. I think that relationship is the key. We are social beings.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear.
Well, listen, we're getting near to our half-hour break. I hope that I'm in touch with my engineer for today, Matt, who's a wonderful man, and that we will be going to the break. And when we come back, I want to pick up again with you about any subjects that are of interest to you. And perhaps as we go to break, you could tell folks what your best contact information is.
Oh, my best contact information, my website, www.emotionalmedicinerx. And I have a Facebook page, Emotional Medicine RX, as well. And I would love to hear from people, and you can find access there about how to buy my book and how to be in touch with me, and which I would love.
We'll be back in shortly with Penelope Andrade, who is from Southern California. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, returning you to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. And my guest, Penelope. Penelope, help me. I don't know if I've been massacring your last name.
You've done a great job.
You, over there, in
New York, have done a great job.
well, tell folks how to pronounce it. So,
well, I was going to be young forever after my first marriage. That's my maiden name, and then I met my husband Arturo Andrade. It's Andrade.
Andrade.
Andrade, and you did a great job. Yeah. So
let me spell it for folks. It's A N D. R-A-D-E, A-N-D-R-A-D-E. Tell us about your marriage, if you feel like it. I really enjoyed hearing about it and how much you two care about each other. I really think, you know, a lot of folks who will be listening to a show like this have really probably lost their faith in a really loving relationship, a relationship that that exceeds all expectations and imaginings, as I say in my dedication to Ginger in the psychiatric drug withdrawal. The relationship exceeds all my expectations and imaginings. And let's talk some about that, about marriage.
Well, you know, that brings tears to my eyes just talking about my honey, Arturo, who's in the other room listening online. And, you know, I never could have picked him out. I don't think my small mind would have allowed me to pick out Arturo, and it would not have allowed me to imagine what it's like to be supported by someone and to be sharing a life. And we are 22 years now. 22 years, and we have a lively relationship. We fight, we make up, we do it over, and we deeply, deeply love each other, and we have a lot of fun together. So I, you know, as I was grieving the loss of my first marriage, and it took me six years until I found Arturo, and I had no idea. I couldn't have predicted that I would have found something this fulfilling. And when I, you know, as I looked back, even though I wouldn't wish on any family a broken marriage, because it's ongoingly hard for the children of that marriage, and it's you know, not an easy thing for my beloved son Adam. He's adjusted, he's well adjusted, but it's not ever an easy thing for children. But I really believe that I know that my former husband is really found his soulmate in the person that he fell in love with, and I know that. And he ended the marriage, and he created the possibility of me finding Arturo. So I don't know how to get around how hard that is on children, but for me, it was better. It's better for me to have gone through what I went through and discovered what I discovered and been able to open my heart and receive the kind of love that Arturo gives me. And so, yeah. It's great. And I know from the way you talk about Ginger, and I know, that you have that same experience of finding love. And I would say to people, don't ever give up. Don't ever give up. Yeah. And even, especially when it gets hard. Especially when it gets hard. That's the time to drop into your feelings. There's a wonderful form of therapy that Arturo and I do, that I and Sue Johnson has written a book called Hold Me Tight. So I want to put in a plug for that kind of therapy. When we run into a jam, we go to a therapist for a session and find our vulnerable hearts and love for each other again. So I would say don't give up, and I'm sure it's out there for anybody who really has a heart full of love to give and receive.
I have found in my therapy practice that when a person opens their heart to love, which is not easy, they usually find somebody surprisingly faster than they imagined. And I don't know spiritually how that comes about, whether our intended couples are hanging out near each other without knowing it. I'd be interested in what your own spiritual concept is about that. But when people open their hearts to loving, which is a very central part of the work that I do, there are so many people who also wish they could open their hearts to love and find somebody who is open to love, that they don't go lonely for very long.
Yeah, I have found that. I have found that absolutely true, and I'm glad you mentioned this because it brings up something else I wanted to talk about, which is that the reason that I wrote my book to help people find love within themselves at the moments when they didn't have somebody there. So, although if you haven't found love and you really want it, and you've got years and years of history of not finding love, and yet you really want it, or you think you want it, I say, of course, find therapy. If you want to also, at the same time, work within yourself to find a way that you can help heal yourself along this process, the times when your therapist isn't there, or when you're in love with somebody, and I don't know about you, Peter, but Arturo and I have found, if sometimes when I'm at my worst, he's at his worst. Those are moments when you need to be able to know how to work within yourself to find your own resources. And one of the, I had a client who came in for a session about 5 years ago, and I was teaching her about the emotional medicine. I was helping her learn to drop into herself and track her sensations and feel her feelings. And she had, very traumatic childhood, very difficult time, was currently going through a miserable divorce, and was tended toward obsessive compulsive. She was just very tight with herself and not able to feel her feelings. And after she learned how to let her body lead, and after she learned how to allow sad, mad, and scared feelings bring her to a place of feeling glad, she said, "Penelope, I've been," she was a student of, she'd been to so many New Age conferences and read so many books and done so much work on herself through, reading and workshops. She said, "All these workshops talk about loving yourself, loving yourself, loving yourself." And for the first time, and this was after she'd had an experience of feeling really, really sad and following that through to the peace and calm that comes up after that, she said, I'm having an experience right now of loving myself. She had an experience. She said, that's the first time in my life. She was in her 40s at the time she came for treatment. I now know what they're talking about. This is what it feels like, that you can have. Now, of course, she was having that experience with me there, so it wasn't outside of a relationship, and it's much, much easier. I was supporting her and facilitating her to find the way that she could find within herself an experience of self-love. And she did that. And I wrote my book to be like to hold people's hands. You know, I really wrote it like, okay, if you don't have a therapist, if you can't afford therapy, if you are have a great therapist, but your therapist is on vacation, or you're at a moment when you need to be able to work within yourself with numbness or, you know, overwhelming, sad, mad, or scared feelings. I wanted to bring my heart and my love to people through my book so that they would have me there by their side. So, and I worked on my book for many, many years, and I had a very strict writing coach, very, very strict, and for 6 years he kept telling me, no, 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 no. And sent it back and sent it back, and I wrote and rewrote and wrote and rewrote, and finally, after 6 years, he wrote me back and he said, you know, reading your book, I felt loved as a reader. And that was for me the most important thing anybody could have ever said. That's the most important thing anybody could have ever said. That I could...
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
I was really happy. I was so happy, especially coming from him, that he'd been so... such a curmudgeon, you know, that... Mm-hmm. So... I agree with you. You know, the relationships are the key. And sometimes, you know, people have such deep wounds and such fear and such numbness and such shutdown that they really do need help. They need loving help. They need empathic therapy. And they need also emotional medicine.
By which, for anyone who has just turned in, analogy does not mean psychiatric drugs.
Right.
Emotional medicine. One thing you said earlier about how when two people, can sometimes both be falling apart in effect, and then you have to rely on yourself. One of the principles that I find really important in therapy applies to that kind of a situation. And the principle is what I call the non-emergency principle, which is that when your client or patient is having an emotional emergency, you do not.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that if your patient says, I'm going to run out and kill myself, you don't have an emergency. You actually just sit there with those feelings and connect better and deeper so that your client doesn't want to run out and kill themselves. They want to stay there and talk to you about their feelings, their thoughts, and similarly that you don't have an emergency by hospitalizing them against their will or giving them medications, that a big key to therapy is that the therapist doesn't go into an emergency mode. And I think that's, if you can keep that in mind in your marriages and in your relationships with your children, your loved ones, it's really key, so that as soon as you see a loved one is having an emergency, then you don't.
As soon as
you perceive they're out of control, you don't get out of control. And if you can keep that in mind, you'll be the strength of the relationship at times when it's really, really needed. And it'll keep you from going crazy, because if you know that you can't lose it because of your loved one needing you, or your client needing you, you will never go crazy. You will always be connected, which is the opposite of craziness. You'll always be connected to the people around you, and particularly the people that are really meaningful to you.
And I would say, because I am not always able to do that in my relationship with my beloved, and I would say, and if you can't do that, then leave the room, go, and I love to slam a door every now and again. Slam the door, go in the room, and take some emotional medicine to clear your own head. That's what I do. When I can't find that kind of clarity and non-emergency state in myself, when I'm at my best, I leave, go into another room, take some emotional medicine, yell and scream, cry, not for more than a minute or two, until focusing on the peace that comes as a result of that and the clarity and the well-being. And then almost always I get insights about my part of the problem. Funny mm-hmm. how that is.
Yeah.
Almost always. When, you know, you get such clarity, I find, you know, moving through emotions in this brief embodied way really opens up my prefrontal cortex. I have, you know, I'm typically aware of, oh my gosh, I wonder if that's what I did that was so troubling to him. Much easier. And, you know, which is reminding me of another something I just read in one of your books the other day that... about, and I don't remember which one it is at the moment, but it was about a patient that called you up and said he wanted medication. And you said to him, why didn't you bring this up in the session? And he said to you, well, you were so distracted. You know, in essence, I couldn't feel you there. And you said, you were right. You'd just gotten some distressing phone call a minute before. Do you remember this?
Oh, vividly.
Vividly.
It's amazingly that you remember it so vividly.
Well, you know, I've been preparing for our interview by remembering, you know, what it is about your work that touches me so much and that has been such a support. And that vignette is a perfect example of what makes relationships work. You know, what makes good therapy work. That you said, yes, I wasn't there. I don't know if you said I'm sorry, but it was something like, you are right. Oh, you offered him a free session. Come in and we'll talk about this. Because it
yes,
was...
Yes, that's what happened.
Yes.
And now, then he didn't need meds. He said, well, then I don't need a sleeping pill.
Exactly. He didn't, you know, he needed a person. He needed that emotional response, that presence, that heartfelt mm-hmm. presence. And... you know, you had enough humility and compassion for him, and, you know, those are principles of your work, that you were able to acknowledge to him, yes, that's true, I wasn't there. I'm so sorry. Come in and I'll give you another session. I mean, that to me is therapy at its best, and there's another form of therapy that I've been studying in addition to Sue Johnson's, which is Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy of Diana Focia. And the focus on the relationship, on the focus on that kind of humble, present relatedness is the foundation of the AEDP. And even though I've been a therapist for over 30 years, I am in training in this new form of therapy, which is focusing on the relationship moment by moment and really being there and addressing, you know, specifically and discreetly what the research shows us is the most important is that empathic relationship.
Well, I'm hugely enjoying talking with you, Penelope. I've rarely felt so appreciated
by one of my guests.
What
glad.
A treat that is for me.
I'm so glad. I'm moved again. I'm moved to tears to think about, and just imagine, you didn't know that I existed until recently, but just
until
think
my
about,
wife discovered you, yes.
Yeah. Until, you know, how many people your life, and I know I said to the other day, gosh, I hope you're in good health because, you know, we need you and we need to have you there carrying this standard. And apparently, you don't have any trouble writing. I mean, it took me 6 years to write one book. How many books have you written?
More than 20.
More than 20. So you just sit down and turn on the faucet?
Writing comes as natural to me as thinking. I've learned to think on paper. So if I can think it and feel it, I can write it. And it's like a direct connection. And it came to me in, I would say, in my 30s. I had 2 published novels in my 30s, and I was working on one of them. And I realized all of a sudden that if I could think of something or feel something or know something, then I could write it down. And furthermore, that often in the writing, I learned more about what I thought and refined what I thought. But I'd been writing my whole life, you know, going back to high school. Mm-hmm. When, as I said, in my 30s, I suddenly realized that I could do that. But then I got a lot of help from Ginger, who came into my life shortly before I started writing Toxic Psychiatry. And while I'd been able to write novels and I'd been able to write scientific papers, I hadn't been able to write really readable nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
I could write the novels. I could write a play. I could write science.
Mm-hmm.
But to write a book of nonfiction that people would where I was bringing in that spontaneous and creative talent was harder.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Ginger did basically what your editor did. I would bring, and this was pretty new in the relationship and with us, I would bring a chapter to Ginger from Toxic, and I would say, "How's this, honey?" And she'd say, "Oh, that's nice." I'd say, do you think I could do some more work on it?" She said, "Yeah, I don't think it got just quite right yet." And I'd say, "Do you think I could just drop it on the floor and start again?" She said, "Yes, you might be able to do it." But she would do it very nicely, only with my prompting. And through that method and a few direct hints from her, like tell a story or that's too complicated or I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right.
I wrote in that process, you know, my breakthrough book, which is Toxic Psychiatry.
Yes.
So she was my therapy editor. Therapists and editors are identical. They just have different material, I think.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Ginger.
I think we are just about over. I'm going to run over.
Oh, my God.
Penelope Young Andrade, A-N-D-R-A-D-E, social worker, author of Emotional Medicine. What a wonder to meet you.
Oh, indeed. I look forward to meeting you both in person.
Yes, come to our April conference. I want to meet you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Goodbye,
bye.
All.
Bye-bye.